Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I am joined by my co-hosts, John Stern.
Hi.
And Seth Manfield.
Hello, everyone.
Dude, Seth, GP top eight, man. Just 1 week into the show, you're already making me look bad. Thanks.
Yeah, I wasn't counting, but I ran into BDM. He told me it was number 17 for me. So, yeah, I mean, you could call it another day at the office, but it kind of feels really good anytime you make top eight of a big event. So I'm definitely feeling happier after this weekend than I did after the Pro Tour and a few other weekends lately.
John, can I ask who has more wins between you two at GPs?
Like match wins? I have more with match wins.
No,
what you're talking about?
I meant who has won more Grand Prix.
Are you asking about the head-to-head battle
between
John and I?
I don't remember. When did we play? Did we play? We must have played.
I believe we're undefeated. We're both undefeated against one another.
Oh, really? I have two GP wins. I think Seth has more, but I don't know how many he has.
Do you know, Seth?
Do I know how many Grand Prix wins I have? I do know that. I do know the answer to that question. It is five.
Oh, that's so many.
Yeah, so he's got slightly...
It's such a large number of Grand Prix wins.
But I haven't won one in like 3 years or something.
So yeah, far. That's terrible. Yeah.
Well, you know,
do you win anything else in those 3 years? I don't know.
I mean, just a Pro Tour, but who's counting?
Like... And Worlds. And I think, did you win Player of the Year too?
No,
you did not win.
Bringing that up.
Well, I did. Oh man, no daggers, man.
I mean, that was literally like.
I thought you won Player of the Year the year you won Worlds. Oh no, did BDM? No, BDM won Worlds the year before.
He got sniped in that one too by Owen.
Oh man,
yeah.
Just the daggers all over today. Well,
thanks for a little history lesson on my Player of the Year woes.
No problem, Seth. No problem. Well, you know, we who won't throw some daggers in your face is our sponsor at Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 5% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood at checkout. And you can check out our other sponsor, Edink Gaming. Use the code CCMTG10 to get a little bit of discount, give us a little bit of a kickback. That's just to kind of help pay for hosting, pay for the equipment, stuff like that. So check out Edink Gaming for playmat sleeves, stuff like that, and check out Oasis Games for your cards. You can check out the rest of the network, whether it's common knowledge to get better at Popper, whether it's Even Odds, your PPTQ podcast, as they call it, and just everything that's going on here. We really appreciate everything that's going on in the network, and we're happy to have them here. So, but if you want to support the podcast directly, you can go to patreon.com/CCMTG. The patrons will never tell Seth about all the times that he didn't win Player of the Year, but they will get asked questions every week. And this week, we have a question from one of our patrons that you can be eligible for, too, if you become a patron. It says, what do you do when you feel like you've hit a wall in your ability to improve at Magic? Let's start with you, Seth.
Well, I don't feel like that's really possible to hit a wall and say you can't improve, because I'm still improving and I'm one of the best that there is. But you can get to, like, you know that there's levels, right, that you can reach. You don't get to a point where you're like, yes, I'm the best possible. Like, I never make misplays. I already choose the right decks. I don't think any Magic player will say that. But you could find yourself hitting a roadblock where you're like, all right, I feel like I've plateaued in my abilities. There's just something that's not clicking. Maybe you're not following your instincts enough, or just something in tournament results. It could be a PPTQs, maybe you're making the top eights, but you're not winning the PPTQs, or it could be at Grand Prix where you're maybe making top 64s or trying to get pro points, but you're not making the top eight, whatever it could be. Sometimes it's hard to pinpoint exactly what that is, because it varies for everyone. It can just be a mindset. You know, not thinking, oh, I'm not going to be able to make the top eight. I'm just playing to go 10-5 at a Grand Prix and get a pro point. Like, that's my goal. So if you set your goal too low, sometimes you're not able to elevate yourself. And then for me, just kind of talking with other players, maybe get a magic coach to kind of figure out, because there are coaches out there, by the way. Not trying to promote myself here, but I am a coach as well as many other players, and there's sites that support you. There's learning tools out there, reading articles. There's a bunch of directions you can go with it, but just try to do something different, I would say, than what you're already doing. Don't get too hung up on mediocre results, and beyond that, the most important thing is don't get too discouraged, because if you go into a tournament or if you get too down on the game, oh, I'm not enjoying Magic right now because I'm losing a little bit, which it's a feeling that everyone has, because the fact is that when you go into these tournaments, it's only the very, very top that really leave feeling, oh, this was great. Like, I had a great weekend with the tournament and I did my best and I came out with the result that I wanted. Because if you look at it, I finished in the top 8, right? And I'm still like, man, I wish I could have won the Grand Prix. But okay, yeah, I'm happy with the top 8 from last weekend. But that was still out of 1,300 players, right? So, like, these opportunities, even for the top players, like, they don't come around that often. So you have to realize that you have to be able to maximize getting lucky in those spots when it comes up.
You know, John, you have 9 Grand Prix top 8s with 2 wins. You know, you've been on the Pro Tour, I mean, I would assume since 2012. You know, that's 6 years now.
I played my first PT in 2000.
Nice. There you go. Well, that's something. Well, that's the thing though, right? Like, you got your first Grand Prix top 8 in 2012. You know, that's 12 years after your first Pro Tour. You know,
Go
ahead.
No, I mean, I stopped playing for school and work for several years, and I basically was like, okay, I'm just never going to top 8. I just didn't top 8. I stopped. My career's over. I'm not playing anymore. I started playing again in end of 2011. Just Nationals was in my backyard, and I just went. And so it was a huge shock for me to top 8 Toronto, and I had a lot of success immediately right after that, and it's sort of, you never know when you'll get it. I've played a lot of Pro Tours, and I've never top 8 at a Pro Tour. I think I'm capable, so... You know, who knows?
So speak to that. Like, you've been, I mean, you have a good Magic career, right? Like, you, how many years in a row have you been gold or silver now? It's been a while.
When I top 8ed, I think it was GP Toronto in December of 2012, I think.
That is correct.
And I've been on the PT since then. 1 year I was silver, but managed to play every Pro Tour. So basically gold for 5 years. You know, that's, I mean, being gold, I played a lot of GPs. So, you know, you have to consider that. Not everyone has that opportunity.
But have you ever,
did you ask me about that?
Well, do you ever have this feeling, right? Like, you know, you've been to Pro Tours nonstop for 6 years. But you know, you feel capable. You feel like there's room to improve, and there's still upward momentum for you to have.
Well, okay, so I think it's important to differentiate a little bit between feeling like you hit a wall in improvement and just having burnout. So when you're learning the game from scratch or first getting into the competitive scene, the learning curve is very steep. You're going to improve a lot very quickly, and that's going to taper off. But it's still, generally speaking, unless there's like a huge flaw in your approach, or you're still going to be on an upward path. So the feeling of hitting a wall is probably just a slowdown in progress. I've talked in the past about how I feel that most people aren't really trying to improve at Magic. They're just trying to do well at their next tournament. So their preparation is just testing their deck, figuring out what deck to play, and they're not really taking active steps to, you know, to get better. They're learning their deck, they're learning their matchups. This is important for the tournament. But when you feel like you're hitting a wall, maybe you need to step back from, you know, the next tournament and less from focusing on the specific result, whether it's top eight of a PPTQ or whatever, and try some things that might show you some of the holes in your game. If you have a group of players that are about the same level as you, I mean, not everyone has that, but you know, you can find someone who's probably close and, you know, go through their game, go through your game, have them tell you what plays they would make. And instead of just being like, I think this because this, think about their answer and think about what maybe you just played really quickly without thinking because you thought it was obvious, but maybe there's more to it. And you can do this even if you don't have access to people. You can watch coverage and, you know, pause it at interesting points and see, especially at the Pro Tour where they show hand cams or tell you what cards are in their hand, and be like, all right, you know, what would I do in this play? And when, you know, PV does something different, like, okay, well, let's break it down. I'm not on the clock. I don't have a match that I have to, you know, play, you know, at a reasonable pace. So let me think, why would he do this instead of this? What's he thinking about? What's in the other person's deck list? You know, what game plan is he building towards that I didn't consider? And, you know, this is not like most people, I think, Magic is fun. They want to play games. So even when you're testing, that's what you want to do. You want to play games. But this kind of thing where you're trying to fill the gaps in your own approach to the game, it's hard work, but I think it can pay off a lot and maybe sort of make that ramp a little steeper and help you break through that wall.
Yeah. As somebody who, you know, I remember, I mean, it was a journey on this podcast, right? I remember saying, like, I'm going to get my first pro point in the next year, get my first pro point. And I was like, I'm going to qualify for my first pro tour. And I did it. And then I remember this, like, utter feeling of feeling like you had to start all over again, right? You qualify for that first pro tour. You're not qualified for the next one. And you're back at zero. And it kind of does feel like a wall. But I think that the differentiation that John is making is really important here, which is the improvements to your game is not directly the improvements to your results at your next event. That's they're not always a one-to-one ratio, and that's important to remember.
I think, like, also something that I've kept in mind, so I don't know, like, I'm one of the players who has played the most PTs without a top eight, and I've kind of like tried to understand, okay, you know, why is this happening, or am I approaching PTs wrong, or is there some flaw in my game? But I think I just understand that if I top eight the next PT, it doesn't mean I'm suddenly a better player. I think it's more a reflection of my preparation for that tournament and the variance in that tournament. So like, you know, I don't feel like if I don't top eight a PT that I'm just not as good as I thought I was. I'm a certain level. I can still improve. I'm still trying to improve, and the results, they'll come or they won't. And I don't attach so much to of my, you know, my ability to how well I've done. I've done well in some things and not done well in other things. And that's just how it is. Like, there's variance in the game.
Well, I think this brings us. Oh, did you have a point, Seth?
Well, I was just going to add that, like what John was saying, like there's variance in terms of specific time periods as well. Like, sometimes there's an opportunity to create a new deck, right? Like, it's the first weekend of a format, and you have the opportunity to really break the format of Standard. Or for a Pro Tour that's only a week or two later, you have this unique opportunity to kind of brew a deck, and that gives you, in my opinion, more of an opportunity to do well, because there's going to be more variance in terms of deck choices, and in terms of preparation is going to be rewarded that much more. But you might not, as players, we don't always prepare the same way for each tournament. Like, if we know that, okay, there's five decks in Standard that are all good and the power level isn't that different between them all, you might think, all right, well, I'm just not going to prepare because I can just pick a deck. Doesn't really matter which deck I pick, and that's fine. Now, I wouldn't recommend doing that, because I think that some players will fall into that trap where, all right, I'm just going to play one of the top three decks, and I'm just going to copy paste a deck list that someone's written about, etc. And that's the approach that most players are using after the first few weeks of standard format, I think, in my experience. But I would, even if you're using that approach, I would still recommend playing the games out, like online, figuring out the sideboard plans, because sometimes those decks and those, you know, even if it's someone you trust, you might want to make your own spin on thing. You might not want to play a deck after actually practicing with it. So I would just kind of, going off the original question, if you're practicing the same way for each tournament, I think then you might think, all right, like, and you don't see an improvement, then maybe you have to go back to the drawing board a little bit. But I don't think that most players are doing that.
I think the innovation in your own approach and innovation in your process is really important, and something that Magic players think that the only thing that matters is just jamming their head against a wall. But I think that the truth is that that's how you create that burnout. And sometimes it's important to figure out new ways of doing things to improve yourself, and improve your process is just as important as improving your game.
I'll also say that, you know, for all the information that's available online. So I played Blue Red Drakes at the SCG Open, the team SCG this weekend, standard. And I didn't play a lot with the deck before. I basically played one league, and I just was playing this tournament mainly for fun because I was in Vegas. But so I took a look at an article by Pascal Viren, who went 10-0 with the PT. And I also read Owen's article about the deck, and their sideboard plans were drastically different. And they're both, you know, they both are great players and have great success with the deck. So, I mean, it's not there's things you can figure out on your own. And just because you read it somewhere doesn't mean that's the be all and end all and you have to do it that way. There could be improvements to be made, and, you know, it's worth playing some games and coming up with your own strategies, I think.
Let's move on to our next segment, which is hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is the point of the show. You know, there's kind of like the point of this question. There's always opportunities to improve. And Seth and John and myself, we're no different. There's so much room to improve in the game of Magic. You know, Seth just said it himself. You know, he's, you know, one of the also, I mean, the dude has a median Pro Tour finish of 67th, as I'm looking at it right now, which seems insane. But he's saying he's still got room to improve. And I think that we all feel that way. John, I'm going to let you go first on this one. You played a tournament for fun this week. How did it go, and what did you learn? Or maybe that's not where you're always improving came from this week.
Well, the tournament did not go well for my team. Well, we missed day two. We went, we had to go 6-3, I think went 5-4, which is not great, you know, not very good. Personally, I think I went 4-5 in standard. So disappointing. I guess one of the flaws in my game, which I'm aware of, and I find team tournaments very difficult. Specifically, I find it difficult when a teammate is asking for my advice in a complicated situation. And meanwhile, I've been focusing on my game, and I'm not really, it takes me too long to get up to speed in their game. There was a situation where, you know, I saw that the modern player who's playing Hollow One was playing against Storm, and there was going to be a crucial gifts given resolving, and I was going to try to help him with the split, even though I really wasn't up on the game state. And the split, it was Pass and Flames, Metamorphose, Paretic Ritual, and Desperate Ritual. And I look at his mana, he's got Baral in play. I'm like, okay, well, if you give him a Ritual and a Pass and Flames, he just can't do anything this turn. And, you know, that's, you don't want to give him the Metamorphose to give him a card draw. So just give him like Paretic and Pass and Flames. And I just didn't know there was a red mana floating. And with the red mana floating, he just easily went off. And I just, my teammate had originally split it so that correctly, which was Pass and Flames, Metamorphose, because he was like, you know, he wasn't really sure about the split, but he was like, I think this is best. And I just didn't know there's a mana floating, and I'm just still trying to get in the game state. And he just took my advice, and we just instantly lost. So, you know, there aren't that many team tournaments. So it's a weakness that I need to address. But one that I'm going to address, which is maybe more relevant, is I find it difficult to take a new deck and sort of iterate on it and figure out which version is best. I usually wait until there's some reliable tournament results. and I've been playing Blue-Red Arclight Phoenix in Modern. Just, you know, I played it at GP Atlanta, and I'm trying to sort of take the process of trying the newer versions, figuring out what works and doesn't work, and being very diligent about taking notes on the matches I play in leagues and, you know, what sideboard plans I tried, and trying to improve my process on tuning a new deck. So that's my immediate goal.
All right. Thank you. I also went to SCG Vegas this weekend. I was playing Legacy. My tournament was actually not very fun for me. I tweeted about this, but we had a round one feature match where some stuff was said on Twitter, and I really let that affect me this weekend. I started out 3-1, so, you know, started out really well, but as the tournament progressed, I just kept thinking about Twitter and things people were saying and how I was going to respond or if I should respond, and I really let social media get to my head, and it's something that I'm going to dedicate myself to working on now. It's a flaw I found in my game. I care a lot about what other people think about me, and I think that it affects me very negatively in Magic, and it's something that I'm going to work on. So, Seth, what about you?
Well, yeah, that's actually a great point, Spencer, because it kind of is similar to how I feel about mine. My result was a good result for the weekend, but there's always room to improve. I feel like I started out with a loss, first of all, in the tournament, which is, it's easy to kind of let that snowball. I wasn't able to let that snowball. I did not let that snowball into you know, I was able to keep my level of play high, even having lost that match and possibly punting the match. I'm not really sure, but it was a very close match. But I would say my always improving moment was when I was being covered, because I am someone that's in the spotlight a reasonable amount, being one of the more well-known players on the Grand Prix circuit. So I was a feature match on day one. I played the match. I thought I played well. I was playing against, I believe, Mono Red. I won pretty handily in the games that I won, and I walked away feeling good with myself. I didn't think about anything I did wrong, any type of misplays. And then the head judge later comes over to me, and he's like, hey, just to let you know, you might get some feedback on this on social media, but you played two lands in a turn. And so that did not feel very good to hear that, because I did not realize that I had played two lands in a single turn, and no one had caught it during the match. It was only after the match that I had heard it. And it was a situation where it was like my 9th and 10th land or whatever. It wasn't like my 3rd or 4th land or anything right. like that. So it was a complicated situation where I don't think the extra land really was relevant in the game itself, but you'll get a lot of, you know, people watching Twitch in the moment. I'm looking back, it was like, this guy's cheating. He's just played a second land drop. You know, the best players are, you know, figuring out weird ways to win, and you'll get people saying whatever nonsense that they're going to say. Right. And you just kind of have to tune it out. You know, it was a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes, whether it's a misplay or just a plain old mistake where you're not following the rules of the game. That was a mistake that I made. And I was happy to end the day and just kind of like think back on it and be like, yeah, I kind of hold myself to a higher standard. Because I am this top pro that people think of, and I shouldn't be making these mistakes, right? But and I can't remember another time when I made the mistake, but I did make it, and then I found myself constantly for the rest of the tournament thinking about, did I play another land? Did I play another land? Because I'm playing these games where I have like 8 or 9 lands in play, and I have like six cards in my hand. But anyways, that's something that I have to improve on clearly, but it happens.
You know, I've said this a lot, and I've tweeted this probably like 50 times. I used to tweet it every Pro Tour, but if I could give a piece of advice to our listeners about viewing coverage, and I'm sure many of you have heard me say this, it's don't watch matches of Magic to correct people. Watch matches of Magic to learn, because even if somebody's worse than you, even if you're better than them, That doesn't mean you can't learn from them. That doesn't mean that you can't take that opportunity to think about what the reason is that they did the thing that they did, even if the thing that they did was, like, wrong. I actually talked to Ben Stark about this once when he was doing coverage. You know, he's like, what do you do when a player just makes a really stupid play? I'm like, oh, you just say it's peculiar and talk about why they might have done it. Because I think at the end of the day, we all want to be better than other Magic players because Magic is so important to us. But that doesn't mean that we can't learn. And I hope that people can learn that from just, like, use coverage as a tool, not as a weapon, is all I have to say.
I also think, just to add to that, specifically what Seth was saying, I actually think that this is a common enough thing that happens unintentionally that there should be something in the rules about it. I don't know how to make that happen, but so it happens with Experimental Frenzy a lot, right? People are casting like four or five spells. They played a land earlier. They don't remember if they played a land. So for Experimental Frenzy, my recommendation is to, when you play the land, you tap the Frenzy. When your opponent plays their land with a Frenzy in play, you ask them to tap the Frenzy, and that eliminates that problem. But in general, I think it was Li Shi Tian actually who suggested it. I know MTG Main Card was doing something like this because it had been an issue in the past where the land you play for the turn, you put in a very specific place on the game board. Maybe you put it with your creatures, you put it, you know, next to your deck, away from your other lands. And then when you pass the turn, you bring it back with the rest of your lands. So you always know.
Yeah, I don't know if that's all of Mint Card, but Li Shi Tian does do that after being accused of cheating.
Yeah, he has started to do that, I think. Yeah. But I mean, I think like that is something that it should just be in the rules. Like that would be, like, it's not just preventing yourself from doing it. It's very taxing to try to remember if your opponent has, because if your opponent spends 30 seconds thinking and then plays a land or asks you, did I play a land? Like, what are you supposed to do? You have to know the answer, but meanwhile, you want to be thinking about your plays. And I think it's something that, you know, both players need to sort of, you know, try to take some step to make sure that's not a problem. That I think everyone should try to do that until it becomes more mainstream. That'd be my suggestion.
Yeah. But well, anyway. Let's talk about your awesome weekend, Seth. Let's talk about this Golgari deck. We're going to move on to our deck of the week. No power rankings this week. We're actually going to do a mega rankings in next week. So we'll actually add up all the standard, like the PTQs, the GPs, some of the SCG results and stuff like that. And we'll give you a definitive power rankings for standard next week. But this week, we're going to go over your deck, Seth, that you top-aided the Grand Prix with. You top-aided Milwaukee. You got sixth place with Golgari Midrange. You played four Llanowar War Elves, two Druid of the Cow, four Merfolk Branchwalker, three Wildgrowth Walker, four Jadelight Ranger, one Midnight Reaper, three Ravenous Chupacabra, three Carnage Tyrant, two Karn, three Vivian Reed, two Cast Down, three Veraska's Contempt, three Fine Finality, 23 lands of 8 Forests, one Memorial Folly, four Overgrown Tomb, six Swamp, and four Woodland Cemetery. Let's go over the deck a little bit and talk about it before we go over the sideboard. But why don't you give us like a simple summary of the deck and why you chose it?
Sure. So I think I like to start by kind of giving our viewers some credit for already knowing that Golgari has been a deck, one of the best decks,
right,
in the format. And so what I'd like to talk about when going over my list is some of the more notable card choices rather than, all right, the deck has four Jadelight Rangers. Come on.
Can we start with the Druid of the Cowls and your reason to play those?
Yeah, so we can start with the Druids. My particular version is a little bit more ramp heavy. So Grand Prix New Jersey, if we flash back a few weeks, I played a similar list to this one, actually. And the list is kind of based around getting your most powerful cards into play as quickly as possible. So I have the most innovative card in my main deck is Karn, Scion of Urza. I've talked about it before, but if you're able to get it onto the battlefield a turn earlier, it's really nice. And I didn't really want to play Seeker Squire for this tournament, which is the weakest explore creature in the deck.
And what is the reason you didn't want to play it?
Well, it's kind of low impact. Either you get a 2-mana 1/2 that draws you a card, which is fine, but you also have a bunch of other small creatures, so that 1/2 creature, like, and that's kind of at its best, right? Most, like, a lot, over half the time you're going to get a 2/3 for 2, and then you're going to get the explorer benefit on it as well, but that's, like, it's not that big of a, like, it's the only reason, the best reason to want to play Secret Squire is for your Wild Growth Walkers, right? Because you have Wild Growth Walker, you want to have a critical number of explore creatures to go with your Wild Growth Walkers. And there is a dilemma there, but I feel like the best card with Wild Growth Walker is certainly Jade Light Ranger by a wide margin. And so that's the one you're really hoping to go with it. And, you know, I would rather have the Druid. I feel like my list also, a lot of lists have kind of been going down on Carnage Tyrants, and even Vivian Reads, like, we'll see lists with, say, 2 Vivians, 1 Carnage Tyrant. My list has 3 Carnage Tyrants and 3 Vivian Reads, so that's a bunch more expensive cards. So I wanted to be able to get them out a turn earlier, and I like Druid. The 3 toughness is relevant. If you cast Finality, you're able to save it, and it's also relevant with your Golden Demises after sideboard, which give all creatures -2/-2, so it happens to be a 2-drop that still stays in play after that.
Yeah, and it's high toughness. It matters in the matchups where you would bring in Golden Demise.
It does, yes. So, and I felt like I was comfortable going to 23 lands with the 2 extra mana sources, quote unquote, with the Druids. And I feel like Golgari is definitely prone to flooding with so many explore creatures. A lot of the times you'll get into situations, especially with the 24 land Secret Squire builds, where you will just explore, and you'll just hit a lot of lands, and you just kind of run out of fuel. And I didn't really find myself running into that issue with my version. I did play only 1 copy of the Memorial, which is a little bit odd considering most lists have 2 or 3 or maybe 0. I went with 1. I do feel like the tap, like, I never activated it at all in the,
oh wow,
the 16 rounds that, or I guess after buys the 13 rounds. So I haven't really seen that card be as strong as others have, and it may be that's because I'm not playing a build that is heavily reliant on Doom Whisperer, because the other builds, if you're going a different direction and you want to be playing these Doom Whisperers, then it makes sense to have more lands and more explore creatures, because you're kind of all in on your Doom Whisperers, casting a Doom Whisperer and then having that be the way you set up the draws for the rest of the game. But since I'm not playing Doom Whisperer in my build in the main, because it's quite bad in the mirror. Chupacabra kills it, Vivian Reed kills it, Contempt kills it, even Cast Down kills Doom Whisperer. So yes, you can bring it back and you can set up your draws with it, but I wasn't happy with it against Golgari, and I felt like Golgari would be and was one of, well, it was the most popular deck, I believe. So and I played against it a good amount. So I wanted my build specifically to be good in the mirror and good against Jeskai, which it turns out that was a good metagame call. And so, yeah, I think I made a good call as far as my list for this weekend.
Yeah, one of the things that I was going to ask was about the Memorial to Folly. I know that one of the things that in my time playing Golgari is that the reason that I want them is because I'm playing Finebroker. And with you not having Finebroker, I was interested to see that you still play the Memorial to Folly.
Yeah, I don't even know if I ran the tournament back if I would have the 1. I think I probably would. There was one game where I just needed a way to bring my Carnage Tyrant back from the graveyard, and I didn't draw it. So it would have been good that one time, but I certainly wouldn't add another one, especially with a Karn strategy, where if you randomly have a tap land the turn you're trying to play a Karn or a Vivian, it's just the difference in the game. So sure. It Like, I come into play tap lands that don't have a huge amount of upside, I'm definitely wary of. And I didn't want to play two. If, like, I'd rather play zero than two. That, I'll put it that way.
Sure. John, what when you looked at John's list before the show, what was your biggest takeaway? Or when you looked at Seth's list, sorry, before the show, what was your biggest takeaway?
From his, well, I mean, I think, so I agree with a lot of what he said about the Seeker Squire. I think that in matchups like Jeskai, the Mirror, Drakes, that the Seeker Squire is kind of an irrelevant low impact thing. Whereas where you really want it is against the aggro decks, like mono white or white aggro decks, white red aggro and mono red, where a 1/3 is also very good. So you're not really losing that much with Druid of the Cowl and you get this extra ramping effect. He already talked about it, but the biggest question for me about black green is the Doom Whisperer versus More Tyrants kind of split. So I played blue red Drakes, and my first round against Golgari, and I had played like a league with the blue red Drakes and I beat Golgari twice, but in round one of the tournament, he goes turn 5 Doom Whisperer and my Drakes deck, you know, I just can't beat it. You know, you can trade with the Drake, but he's got removal. So like he, you know, and he can search for it. So he just turned 5, Doom Whisperer killed me. Games 1 and 3. And I think that even if it's not a main deck card, you had one in the sideboard, right?
I had one in the sideboard and I would go up to 2 in my 75, which if you want to check out my updated list and my sideboard guide, by the way, it is available on the Constructive Criticism group Facebook page.
Yeah, the Constructed Critics group.
Constructed Critics group, but Facebook. But going back to your point, I played one Doom Whisperer in the board, and I thought a lot about the Drakes matchup. I'll be honest, I didn't play against Drakes during the tournament, and there wasn't that much of it, so sometimes you are making a metagame call. Like, Doom Whisperer is better in some matchups, Carnage Tyrant's better in others. In that particular matchup, I found it can be really good unless they have a good draw featuring Beacon Bolt, in which case they might already have 6 spells in the graveyard, and then if you're able to start Beacon Bolting or even Entrancing Melodying in some cases that Doom Whisperer, that can get bad. But if your draw is kind of lackluster and you're relying on Arclight Phoenixes to kind of close out games, I feel like Doom Whisperer is a card that's better against White Weenie, better against Mono Red, and better against Drakes, and worse against Jeskai and Golgari compared to Carnage Tyrant. I want to be playing a list that has access to both when I want them. Like, I want to be able to board out my Carnage Tyrants against aggro, against the matchups where I want Doom Whisperer, and board out my Doom Whisperer for Carnage Tyrants when I want Carnage Tyrants. Mm-hmm. So I want to be able to make that swap because I think that they're very matchup dependent.
And how did you feel about Midnight Reaper? That's a card I was kind of unsure about. You had one main, one side, right?
Yeah. So the Midnight Reaper, similarly, a very matchup dependent card. I like it in the grindier matchups, like against Jeskai and Golgari. And it came up in situations where I was drawing a lot of cards, or against Jeskai, which I went 3-0 against in the tournament, and it was one of the most dominant decks, but I felt like my build was geared towards beating it. I would get a Midnight Reaper into play. Like, if I have it in my opening hand and I get it, it's pretty easy to get it onto the battlefield. And then once it's on the battlefield, the Jeskai players, it's almost like an Adanto Vanguard type card for the Jeskai deck, because they are going to struggle to actually deal with it, and they pretty much still have to Deafening Clarion. But at that point, you're drawing 3 cards, you're untapping, and you're going to land almost regardless a big threat on the following turn. So it's extremely good in those matchups, not as good in the other 3 matchups. So when you look at the list, I was geared towards, like, Golgari is a mid-range deck that intrinsically I don't think it has bad matchups, right? You can kind of tune your deck to be 60% against one or 40% against another. That's the deck. And it's kind of like a Jund style deck. And I have a lot of options after sideboard that I can go to. Flex slots, things of that nature. And so for this particular weekend, I realized that most people that I had heard talk about Golgari going into the weekend were recommending the list with three Doom Whisperers in the main. So my thought process was, okay, this is kind of the level that most pretty solid players are going to be on. Play the list with Doom Whisperers main, promoted by people, by great players like Matt Nass, Brad Nelson, you know, players who have had a lot of success with Golgari. Play Doom Whisperers main, play more of the Carnage Tyrants in the sideboard. But then if you realize that you're on this level of players doing that, then Jeskai becomes a better metagame choice. And I think that's why we saw such a move to the Jeskai side. Yeah. And then I was like, well, wait, if I can just trump, if that's the level that other players are going to be on, I can just go to level 3 and just go back to the Golgari deck that people have been playing with the Carnage Tyrants, you know? Sure. And so that's what I did. So yeah, it's just kind of a circle where you can kind of tune your deck. I felt like Drakes and Mono Red would not be as popular at this event, and I only played against the combination of those decks one time, so it ended up working out for me.
Sure. I think that's kind of like where Standard is headed. Like, you say, like what you said about Black Green, I think it also, maybe to a lesser extent, applies to Jeskai, or even the Drake's deck, where you can customize the deck to beat whatever metagame you expect, and you know the percentages can adjust a fairly decent amount, which is probably a good thing for the format. But I think it also, looking at your list, it feels like you really did a good job of, you know, building a 75 card deck and not a 60 and then a sideboard. Like, the cards are all in there for the right reasons, and then which ones ended up in the main deck, you know, is maybe less important than which cards are in the deck list as a whole.
Yeah. So I'm going to wrap this up by just saying, if you want to see Seth's updated list, as well as his new sideboard guide, go to patreon.com/ccmtg, become a patron of $12 or more. You'll get access to the Constructor Critics group, and you can join Seth on his goal to, level 3 people with Golgari, I guess. So.
I also, for those interested, I posted my 4-5 blue-red Drake's list and sideboard guide.
Did you like the deck, though? Because, I watched, to be fair to John, I watched one of his matches where I'm pretty sure John was, like, close to 90% to win, and his opponent, like, draws a card, looks at it, it's like, oh, okay, like, plays Mystic, and then just, like, triple spells, and I'm just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I don't know which match you're talking about, it kind of gives an indication of how my tournament went. I think the deck is good. I went 3-1 versus Mono Red, 1-1 in the mirror, and then I lost to Black Green, Jeskai, and Mono Blue. I think the deck's good. I don't even really think it has terrible matchups. I mean, I feel like I'm favorite in the Mono Blue matchup. I feel like I'm at least close against Black Green. I think I'm probably rather play my side. I don't know, depending on their version. Feel good in the Mono Red matchup. Okay. So yeah, I think the deck's fine. And you know, like I said, I'm in Vegas. I played this tournament for fun. I played one league with Blue Red and then decided to play it. So my sideboard guide is maybe a starting point. I would say I looked at Pascal Viren's list and sideboard guide and Owen's and sort of thought about each matchup, and this is what I came up with. I have some non-conventional strategies. I was boarding out Arclight Phoenix in the mirror, for example, which I don't think anybody's doing. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's right. So
yeah.
Take a look if you're interested.
I mean, it looked like Mystic was the best card in the mirror by a substantial margin.
Yeah, I mean, also Niv-Mizzet is pretty strong.
Yeah, sure. I guess Niv-Mizzet just trumps those little birdies. So, well, let's move on to our training grounds this week. This week we're going to talk about not compounding mistakes. So the point of the training grounds, by the way, is, you know, not every week, but we want to often do a topic that's just going to help you in your overall Magic game. And this has been a part of the podcast for 5 years now. And this week we're going to bring back one of our oldest topics, and the origin of this topic came from a former co-host, Matt Kling, where, you know, he found that people, they and even some of our closest friends and some of our friends on the Pro Tour, they would
make a mistake, and then rather than looking foolish, they would do a different thing than the correct thing to do. And it brought about this conversation about once you make a mistake and you realize it's a mistake, what's the next thing that you should be doing after that? So I'd like to start, John, with with starting from zero again. So you've made this mistake. You know what's wrong. How do you get to the point in your head where you're like, okay, where am I at now, and where do I go from here?
Okay, so I honestly, for me, it starts before that. And so I'm not a player. I don't really tilt very often when I'm playing Magic. You know, my opponent gets lucky, whatever is part of the game. I'm pretty even, you know, level-headed at in these situations. And I think part of that is that I try to think about scenarios long before they happen. I don't mean like even in the game or the tournament, but okay, so a very common thing that can happen is, you know, you cast your spell before you play land. Maybe you wanted to play your land after combat or something, whatever. And, you know, they spell pierce it or they daze it. And then you're like, well, I'm not going to play that land now because I look like an idiot. So I just think about this situation. Okay, we can agree, I think, that after you make a mistake, the goal is to continue to play as well as you can. You don't want to be affected by tilt. So I'm just thinking, you know, ahead of this, if this ever happens to me, I didn't play land and it gets spell pierced, I'm not going to think about what I should do. I'm going to play the land. That's the correct play. And, you know, I'll think about later, maybe I lost the game because of this play that was dumb, but I've already decided how I'm going to react in that situation. I sort of visualized that this could happen and it could be something else. It could be a bad double block. It could be something that, you know, like, look what happened to Ken Yukihiro at Worlds. He drew a sideboard card, waited a turn to call it on himself, and got DQ'd. And I've already thought about the scenario. If I draw a sideboard card, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to do. I'm not thinking about what I should do, what the rules say. I'm calling a judge. And, you know, I'll get a game loss. That's what's going to happen. And I, you know, thinking about these scenarios before they happen not only helps you play correctly from that point on, but also lets you sort of take the emotion out of it a little bit. It's like I've already decided that when this bad thing happens, this is what I'm going to do. I don't have to think about, oh, geez, look what I did. I can just, okay, this is my next goal. My next task is to play correctly from this point on. I think some people have trouble with feature matches or top eights because of the pressure, and kind of thinking about how you're going to behave in these scenarios, even if you don't expect them to happen, will kind of let you scale back the emotional response. And I mean, it's worked really well for me. So that would be my advice, doing something like that. One of my favorite, I want to give you a link after, maybe you can put it in the show notes. A friend of mine, Mani Davuti, was playing in the finals of GP Vegas at 2017. He's playing Affinity versus Hate Bears. He mulls to four in game two, but he won game one. And he has a really good start. And at some point in the game, he has a plating on an Etch champion, which is going to be very difficult for his opponent to beat. But he's trying to be efficient. He plays the Steel Gear, and he immediately declares that he's moving the plating to the Overseer. And he's tapped out except for Springleaf Jump. He thinks for 2 seconds, and he's like, no, wait, what if he plays Stony Silence? And even though it looks really silly, he immediately taps the Springleaf Drum, taps the Steel Overseer, and puts the plating back on the champion.
I remember this play.
And it's just, that's such a, like, you have to have respect for someone who's like, you know what, it doesn't matter. I look stupid, but I'm going to win this tournament, and I'm going to play correctly. And, you know, he won. He didn't win because of that reason, but I just, it's something that I think everyone should strive to do, is to just, you're trying to play as well as you can in every situation, whether there's people watching, whether there's, you know, whether it's playing for $10,000 or for an invite or whatever, you want to be playing optimal Magic and forget what happened before and just do the correct play. And, you know, I have to have respect for someone who's able to do that, because not everyone can.
Seth, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think there's two different ways to answer this question. One is what you should do, and one is what I do. Like, I'm not perfect, but I'll start with what I think you should do, which is don't get caught up in the mistake. Everyone makes them. You can't go into a tournament thinking you're not going to make any mistakes, right? And you should take every game as a lesson and just kind of realize, even if you win the game, and I think this is where a lot of players get caught up in, they are a lot of people, and this is very natural, if you lose a game, especially, or a match, especially if it's an important match and you care about it, you are more prone to look back on it and kind of try to figure out, what could I have done differently? Did I misplay? Maybe there's an obvious misplay that cost you the entire match. Either way, you're more likely to reflect on it with a loss than a win. But if you win the match, that doesn't mean that you play perfectly either. You should still be looking at a match and thinking about how you can improve upon it for future, because that's how you're going to improve. And so for me, that's my advice. For me, what I do is I will, because I never want to make mistakes, even though they're going to happen, and they did happen even this weekend. I made some boneheaded plays. Luckily, when I made a big mistake, my opponent in turn made a big mistake, and then I was still able to win because they punted the game back to me. But there was these situations where in the moment, I think that it's natural to just kind of get caught up in your head. Sometimes you make a play and you just kind of slow down. You think to your brain just kind of shuts off, and like, you're still in the middle of a game, right? Like you still have to finish out the match, even though you just made a big blunder. So I think that some players will just kind of like stop thinking. They'll maybe like slow down and, you know, do things like that. Or then some players will just kind of like tilt and they'll just play very quickly and just kind of go through the motions because they want to get out of the chair, run to a corner of the convention center and just sit down and just, you know, put their head down. And that's fine too. For me, I take misplays, especially when they cause me to lose a big match, pretty seriously. Like, I hate it when it happens, even though it happens to everyone. I'll go to my friends and kind of talk them through a line, even though I know that the line I took was the wrong line. I'll be like, hey man, like, what would you have done in this circumstance? And of course they tell me the right play, and I'm like, yeah, I didn't make that play. And it's just an embarrassment. Okay. Sure. It happens. Don't feel embarrassed. Like, it's just part of the game. Like, if you're able to learn from your misplays, then it should be a win. If you're able to think about the long run, don't never go into a tournament and feel like if you make a misplay, it's going to be, you know, a miserable experience, because then you're going to, well, have a miserable experience.
Yeah. I think, to kind of to build on that, there have been a couple of tournaments, and specifically in top eights, where I feel like I've made a mistake. And, you know, I think that collecting yourself is totally fine. Like, if you're specifically in untimed matches, like, I've asked the judge if I can just go to the bathroom really quick and wash my face and come back and just, like, play your best magic, because the mistake already happened. Like, Now it's your job to move forward. Like, that is your job from here. Have any of you guys ever watched Gabe Nassif's stream?
I have. He cares about the matches, I can tell you that.
Yeah. He's pretty notorious for playing badly and then and then overcompensating by playing some of the best magic. It's really funny. I've talked to multiple pros about this where, you know, he'll make a mistake. He'll kind of be like, okay, well, I just goofed. Where do I go from here? And he will kind of just play out of his mind from there. And because honestly, that's all that you can do from that point forward after that mistake. Right, John?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you want. I mean, in this tournament, the SCG Open, round one, you know, I hadn't maybe had enough coffee yet or whatever, and I hadn't played the deck in paper, and I'm like, turn two, Electromancer. Turn three, tap two mana, cast chart of course, and not be able to do another spell that turn. And I'm like, as soon as I pass turn, I'm like, oh, that was pretty dumb. It only costs one mana. But, you know, I try to play pretty bad. I mean, I didn't tell my modern player, oh, look what I just did, because I didn't want to tilt him. But sure. Yeah. And, you know, you just try to play correctly from that point on, and, you know, it's over. Like, you just got to play the best magic you can.
You know, Yeah, I completely agree. One of the things that we have in these notes is just talking about embarrassment. Because it's funny to think about your opponent is not does not it doesn't matter. So I had a former listener of this podcast was playing against Owen at an SEG in Vegas. And he cast Thoughtseize in the mono black mirror against Owen. So it's pretty late in the game. He's very far ahead, and he just to check before attacks, he just casts Thoughtseize. And Owen just looks at him and says, okay, that resolves. It marks his 2 life. And then Owen just puts up his hands because he was empty-handed. And after the match, I was like, Owen, talk to me about that Thoughtseize line. And Owen just says, oh, that was peculiar. It's funny to think about, right? But Owen doesn't care. Like, Owen's just trying to win his match of Magic, and it's your job to do the same. Let's be honest. In 3 months, Owen's just going to tell the story about the time that he lost to the dude that Thoughtseized him with 0 cards in hand. But you know what happened? Is that you won the match versus Owen. So, like, who cares? Just, like, play your best and move forward. The embarrassment is only on you. At the end of the day, you're just another person that signed a match slip for everybody else. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely made plays like that, I play Magic for a different reason. I mean, it's great if my friends think I'm good. I don't really like it if they think I'm bad, but, you know, I'm playing the game for the personal challenge of trying to do well. And, you know, if that's, you know, maybe they used to have Elo. I don't think they still have like the Elo project, but that was kind of how I felt. Like, I have that tournament, my Elo goes down. That's okay. I have more chances to build it back up, and eventually it will be where it should be, or I'll get the results that I should get. And I don't know. You just need to take a step back and laugh at yourself sometimes. And, you know, things like that are going to happen.
Seth, when you think about this, you made a huge mistake. You're probably not favored to win from the point that you made the mistake. Where do you go from there?
It's hard not to have an immediate emotional reaction, even though you're still playing the match. As you mentioned, you know, maybe you try to go to the bathroom or get a drink of water. That's not what I do personally. I mean, it's Magic. Like, everyone's going to make those mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes are going to lose you the games. Other times you will make a mistake and it won't end up mattering. I just kind of like to realize that it's part of the game. It's part of what you sign up for playing these tournaments, you know? And I think that beyond that, realize that there is this time issue factor that we've all heard of that discussion a little bit, social media wise in Magic, is this idea of slow playing. And sometimes you don't have the time to think about every single line. You will, yeah. And I'm someone personally that loves to sit there and think about every possibility. But I think that you want to be able to not put yourself in those situations and take a reasonable amount of time to make your play. Like, I've talked to Owen Turtenwald, one of the best players to really ever play Magic. And he told me, when I asked him, hey man, like, how should I play faster? I'm trying to speed up a little bit. He just said, well, what I do is after 15 seconds, if I don't know what to do, I just make a play and I live with it. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. So I think you will get into complicated situations in game states, especially where multiple players are going to take different lines of play, because you'll get into situations where sometimes it's a boneheaded misplay. Other times it's a more complicated misplay, but it's still a misplay that can cost you the match. You know, like, I was playing matches this weekend, multiple times I explored into a Fine Finality on top of my deck, left it on top because it's one of my best cards. My opponent for the rest of the game would play around Finality as if I was going to cast it on the next turn, and then I would eventually cast Find and win that way, when maybe they could have played in a different way, that type of thing. Like, these types of smaller misplays can happen too. So I think that a lot of the some of the misplays are obvious boneheaded mistakes, and then others are misplays that you want to kind of go back and watch, reflect. Maybe it's with your opponent. Optimally, it's on coverage where everyone can see and they can tell you, or maybe there was a spectator that was kind of like, hey, why did you make that play? And you can, so, and those plays are plays that you may not have realized you could have taken a different line to win a game. So I think there's multiple approaches here, but I personally like to, even though sometimes my stomach drops in the moment and I'm like, I wish I could take this moment back, but you just have to realize, yeah, it's magic.
I just kind of wrap this up by saying, I think that we're all going to make mistakes. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you're at in Magic. You're going to make a mistake. And it's your job to move forward from that mistake. It's not your job to beat yourself up for the next, 20 minutes about this mistake. It's your job to win the match of Magic in front of you. That's your only job when you're playing Magic. So once you've made that mistake, do that. Win the match. Or do what you can to win the match and move on from there. So if you want to go to patreon.com/ccmtg to become a patron, our next goal is to get tokens of John and Seth made. So, let's get that done. What are you going to be, John?
I have to think about it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. John will tell us what he's going to be next week. but yeah, if once we hit that goal, we'll get those tokens made and get them shipped out to our patrons. So patreon.com/ccmtg. You can find me on Twitter at Spencer13H. You can find Seth at Seth Manfield. You can currently find John Stern at John Stern. Is it MTL?
MTL, yeah.
Yeah. You can find the podcast at CCMTG. You can go to constructivecriticism.com to listen to the podcast. Check out the other stuff on the network. You can also check it out on the YouTube channel, as well as some other video content. You can join the conversation on Discord. If you go to the bios page that will be updated soon, you can get the link there. You can also join the Constructive Criticism family, open Facebook group for all the listeners. And if you are a patron of $12 or more and you want access to the sweetness that is John Stern and Seth Manfield's sideboard guides, you can join the Constructive Critics group. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening this week. We really appreciate it. John, what did you learn this week on the podcast?
On the podcast specifically, well, I learned about, black, green, and standard, because it's a deck I haven't played really that much. And I don't know, just like thinking about Magic and answering these questions sort of is re-motivating me to, put in more time during the week to try to, right now I'm working on the modern Arclight Phoenix deck, and hopefully, keep at it.
Yeah. So what about you? What'd you learn this week?
Well, I learned that everyone, I make a great point. I think I've answered the question thoroughly. And then I hear John's answer, or I hear your answer, Spencer. And I'm like, wow, those are also really great answers. And everyone has their own perspective on these questions. And I feel like I'm learning a lot hearing from you guys. And I think that at the start of the show, when John said, hey, everyone has kind of this upward trajectory as far as a learning curve where it may slow down, but it's never going to stop. That was, to me, it was a great point, and is something that's going to stick with me and I'm going to think about moving forward.
Yeah. I learned that Seth has never won Player of the Year, and I'm really terrible and I feel really bad.
I haven't won Player of the Year either, so,
Yeah, but you did tell me that your Hall of Fame tokens are in the mail, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
In case you were wondering, I know that you didn't ask me, but I'm hoping John doesn't steal the construct tokens, because
I was gonna say I guess I think Karn. I do think Karn is great though, and I love playing that card.
I
like that you put it in every deck you're playing in standard.
I think the card's just solid. So thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you guys all next week.